about your... Don't you have a greeting for me? Today of all days. Ending and beginning day. The day of death. And you... Try... Merry Solstice. Or... Solstice greeting. I tell you, your children are wiser than you. You still don't remember me, do you? Think back. Think back to the very beginnings. Back to a time when the long darkness brought hunger to your fireside. A black stranger to live with you. The dull pain of famine. Think back to the times of the pounding heart, the ache of the chase, the madness of the kill, the smell of blood hot on the snow, the red and the white. Red and white. Do you remember me now? Your children draw pictures of me. An old man in a red suit with a white beard squeezing down the chimney with all they want most in the world. Lord of the reindeer, keeper of the game, as old as mankind. I am the shaman, the magician, the priest. When your heart beats fast in the dead of night, I am there. When you whistle or sing in the face of danger, I call the tune. I am your ancestor and your child. Here is my invitation to your house, a green tree from the northern forests. See? Some things you still remember. An evergreen tree hung with lights and mirrors, sparkling gold like the glimmer of solstice fire through the forest branches, red and white, blood on the snow. And today, the day of endings and beginnings, of death and rebirth, the birth of the sun, the solstice. The running of the deer, the rising of the sun, a song in praise of the woods and the forests, the beasts and the seasons. And then one day the Christ people came, turning their backs on what is and demanding what should be, as if they were lords of it all. They took that song and made it theirs, just as they took my solstice festival for their own. The sun. The birth of a sun. As it always was, for as long as mankind has gaped at the sky and questioned the light and the darkness. Birth of a sun. Birth of a boy child. Their festival is a trick of words, a fashion of the last few seconds of the history of man. While they try to drive me back into the shadows before their newborn godling, the Christ people still feared me. For the shaman was their ancestor too. The blood on the snow. So, they tried to tame me, contain me, cage me, turn me into a tale for little children, a bringer of gifts, a driver of reindeer, an old man from the north with a white beard and a little magic. But their children were wiser than they. In their turn, they remember the solstice fire. Smell the chill on the wind. Black winter is here too. The red and white bridges ahead. Agaric, the shaman's mushroom, the crossing to the spirit world. Eat. Soon you will see the magician's reindeer fly again, skimming the snow. Speckled deer, right. riding the northern winds, pulling a sleigh with an old man in a red coat ringing bells. I tell you, your children are wiser than you. The dark forest presses on each side. The ice casts an iron band round your chest, snatching breath. But there, ahead, is fire. Solstice fire.
Kindle the fire. Heat to heat, light to light. Give back fire to the sun at midwinter. Bring new fire to each home. A burning log from the forest. Fire to ease the birth pangs of the sun.
The stones of the earth remember a time when the sun did not return to them from the darkness. Then ravenous ice engulfed the land, bringing nothing but stark, white silence. The very mountains were split and milled to sand. Brothers of the natural world, and you others, silent watchers from the shadow world, long dead and unborn. It is the night of longest darkness, the time of greatest danger. The solstice fire burns as a sign to the sun that it must return, or we shall be left in the ice of eternal blackness. None here, O sun, have forgotten our debt to your warmth and light. Someone here has failed to trust. There is a lawbreaker here who has forgotten the custom.
How can you possibly know?
Hunter, your feet are on the ground. Your nose is pressed to the blood trail. I fly high above your head, high enough to see what's to come. And I tell you, the world will be turned on its head.
Raven, you are a liar, just as always. How could anyone who lives under the sun forget the sources? And the old laws.
Are you going to tell them how to live off the earth and not in it? How to become its master?
I tell you, where they have passed, the grass is scorched away, and the trees die as if withered by a brush fire, except that no green shoots follow. They destroy faster than they can grow. The cycles of seed and harvest are no longer something to live by, but something to be altered. The animals are no longer brothers, but slaves.
How could they have forgotten?
Knowledge has made them stupid. Seeing too much has made them blind. One thing they are sure of, that anything simple is a tale for little children.
And so the children are the keepers of the truth.
And your children are wiser than you. Perhaps they can tell you why every year you set up an evergreen tree from the forest, like those about you now. Do you think it is simply to please them that you hang shining sun images upon it? Or is it because in the beginnings of time, your forefathers hung dead sacrifices on the living timber as gifts to the reborn sun? And still you utter the words, Yule log, without remembering the burning branch from the forest which brought the solstice fire to the hearth. If you forget the very roots of belief, if you forget the earth and its laws, you are lost.
Welcome, this is Red Eyes Radio. I'm Henrik, thank you for tuning in today. This is the winter solstice, or the Yule, if you will, season 2015 already. Well, I hope you're having a good time wherever you are. Well, we are going to talk about the significance of the season today. This is an important time to our ancestors. We have a few things lined up for you today, and we're going to have, a kind of a laid-back discussion about the celebrations with some of the people from our team who make Red Eyes happen. And almost everyone is here. Lana, of course, is with us. You know her from Radio 314, and you've seen her in some of our videos as well.
That's right. Hello.
And John is here with us as well.
Hey, how's it going, everyone?
You're handling, of course, our radio show uploads, graphics, also news posting, and assisting us with some of our video work as well. Kind of an all-around kind of guy who does a little bit everything that we throw his way. And then we have Melanie is with us here as well.
Hey,
how's it going? She's with us, well, on, I guess, halftime. No, a little bit more than that. We actually have so much to do. It's so busy. And so thankfully, Melanie can help us out a little bit more than halftime. She's doing the those extensive texts that you see on the websites, excellent stuff, and also, of course, booking shows for us and, doing some of the communication with our guests as well. And unfortunately, we don't have Fredrik with us today, my older brother. He's been with us almost from the first few shows that I did in the beginning. He's busy today, unfortunately, couldn't make it. But he's the guy who mixes and edits and, cleans up all my messes and all that stuff, renders out all the radio shows and adding the music and that kind of stuff into it. And he's also doing some of the communication with our beloved and dear members out there, as you might have talked with Fredrik as well. So a great group of folks here who make it all come together. And, we're going to, of course, expand on the project that we do on Red Eyes and bring you more content ahead, much more video work as well. I want to begin with you, Lana. We've just kind of released a new video, actually, that you initiated and you decided to write about some of the things we'll get into today regarding Christmas and Yule and some of the kind of frauds around the season as well. Why did you want to do the video?
Well, growing up Christian, you usually celebrate Christmas. You hear the story of Jesus being born, and I kind of feel cheated because as I've been waking up to my true heritage and looking into my pre-Christian history, I learned that there's a whole story there that has pre-Christian origins, that's rich with myth and ritual and allegories and really powerful stuff. And so I've been looking into that, and a couple months ago, because I knew Christmas was coming up, I just went kind of die hard into it, and I pulled out some real beauts in there that I wanted to be able to share with everyone. So I said, let's do a video about this. But then I also looked into, there's two other imposters that happened during the solstice time, and that's Kwanzaa and Hanukkah. So I began looking into the roots of these manufactured holidays that are basically hijacking the energy of the winter solstice, and found a bunch of dirt there. So I'm presenting that in a video.
There's some really fun stuff in there, too, by the way. So recommend people to take a look at it if you haven't seen it already. Did you know anything about the pagan kind of origins of some of the traditions, some of the stuff that we do?
No, I remember as a teenager briefly kind of hearing something about it in passing, but no one elaborates these things to us. All these adults in our life when we're young don't tell us these stories of what the origin point of, all these traditions and rituals are and what the winter solstice is. We're just completely cut off from that. I know you being in Sweden, you're more in touch with Yule. You still say Yule, but in America, we're completely cut off from that. I think John and Melanie would agree with that.
Well, how about you guys? Did you have any idea of some of the more kind of pre-Christian traditions of why we do certain things on Christmas? Was that part of when you were growing up?
No, not the traditional aspect of Christmas that you could later see when you dive into that subject. I was personally raised up on the pop culture Christmas that Coca-Cola and, you know, Disney sort of like presented for us. And so it was all that that poppy look with red and white, and it, you know, more focused on getting presents and the bigger presents. And my parents themselves, they didn't really know anything more than what the television was trying to teach us about these holidays or these days of celebration. And so it took for me to get into these things like later on in my life to find out that they're much, much deeper in origins.
Well, I wonder if things changed in America, or if it was only kind of the same image all the time, because I remember kind of a very different Santa, not that really red and white kind of, I guess the really Coca-Cola started marketing halfway through somewhere.
But we know red and white is important, though.
No,
we'll talk about that
later. Of course. No, it is. It's not that, but it's just kind of,
it becomes
more of a plastic version of it. It seems like we had more kind of earthy tones, I remember, in Sweden. And since we have, in Europe, it's a more, it's a more set tradition that is much older. But I wonder if some of the Europeans that came over to America, if they brought that with them in any way. I really don't know how things were in the beginning in America. Does anybody know?
Well, I mean, I think there's traditions have been here for, just as long, but I think through commercialization, capitalism, just selling products, that sort of is where things started to change in the advertisements. But prior to that, I personally had a sort of more earth tone kind of traditional look with the Easter holiday.
Right.
And that sort of kind of connected me to find that old German style, natural kind of more like browns and greens, reds and whites.
So Krampus.
Yeah.
or the Julbock, as we say in Sweden, the goat with the big horns. I mean, I guess it would be, I think it was a little bit more maybe kind of hardline Christianity in America. A lot of Christians that came over, so maybe they didn't kind of bring some of those traditions with them. I really don't know.
I think, too, a lot of writers and poets began taking it and kind of spinning it into this fantasy, whereas Yule is actually very earth-based, about the cycles and the changing season. But as writers got in there, as publishing started happening, as we find more reindeers are added, Rudolph doesn't come till 1939, it's a Jewish man who invents Rudolph, and then he becomes a part of this myth, and all these people are constantly kind of adding on to it, and I feel that it's a distraction from the real thing. But of course, still, even with the Santa story and the reindeers, embedded is some important things, which I know we'll get into.
Do you know the name of the guy who did who brought in that extra extra reindeer to make them? Well, I mean, it's interesting though, because 9 is also an important number. In at least in Norse myth.
Oh, yeah, of course. We had the 9 worlds. Odin hung for 9 days. Thor took 9 steps before falling to the ground, killing a serpent. You had the 9 fertility feasts and 9 years. And, I mean, it comes up a lot of times, 9 in Norse myth.
Yeah, I know the Blut was the classic kind of story that comes to us. Is actually, it's interesting because it comes secondhand to us. There's a monk, I guess, from Germany called Adam. From Bremen or Bremen, it's a city in Germany, and he has a secondary guy who actually goes up to Uppsala, which is like the important ritual site where a lot of this stuff was happening. I think every 9 years they had like a big blut where a lot of people from even other countries came and all that kind of stuff. It's a huge thing. So and then they have smaller ones every winter solstice, but not as big as those every 9 year. But he went to Uppsala, and he said, he was apparently terrified by all this, everything he saw. But they said they sacrificed 9 of every male animal. And I don't, who knows what probably every animal that they had in the region or something, he was shocked at everything he saw. But this is what made the trees and the grove, which these Germanic people worshipped in, that's what kind of made it sacred, right? You were hanging these gifts, these sacrifices up in these trees. And I mean, that's really, it's just what we do today.
Well, then as the blood drips onto the snow there, you find your red and white. So it's the sacrifice and the winter. And then of course, gold comes from the sun and from fire, but also you can, and green comes from the trees. But then, so there's the sacrifice aspect, you know, to the gods, blut, as you say. But then also there's the fertility aspect, which people have also thought, I mean, with the mistletoe, we can talk about that too. But red also can symbolize menstrual blood from a woman or from giving birth, and then white, of course, is semen. So then you have the fertility procreation aspect of Christmas as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's a lot there. There's a lot of layers to it. It's quite interesting. I mean, it's people don't know why they bring in a tree, you know, into their house every year, and what that symbolizes.
That one's kind of like the most obvious of the symbols.
Yeah.
Still pagan, but all these Christians, they still bring these trees in, and it's not that easy to, you know, go out and get a tree and put it in your house, because, you know, it gets all over the place, and, you know, it's kind of a big ordeal for the next month, you know, that people take care of this thing and water it, and but yet they don't know where that origin is.
Plus, they thought it was magical, right, Henrik? Because these trees never seem to die. Like the winter plants we associate with Christmas, you know, holly, ivy, evergreen, spruce, all these plants,
mm-hmm.
they still keep their needles year-round, right?
Yeah,
so they were impressed by that.
They're green.
This is magical.
Exactly. It's a tree that defies the seasons, basically. It must be divine, right? It's been given something else. And what's kind of weird about it is that the pine showed up fairly late, too, in Sweden. So it could be, it was like kind of slowly spreading from the north and down, from Finland and Russia up in the very, very north tip of Sweden. And it was slowly kind of migrating down, I think. And it could be that someone actually planted some of these early in some of the regions more south in Sweden. So when they showed up, they were like brand new. No one had, well, maybe they've seen them before, but it was, you know, they weren't that aware of them. So they became very important and very, you know, very magical and mystical to a certain extent. And some of them that grew, they were like huge. It was like giant branches on these things, you know, and therefore you could like literally you could hang horses from this thing. You could hang probably moose, you know, who knows what all these animals that they sacrificed, maybe even humans. There's still a contention about that. I really don't know. So there are apparently some stories that talked about that people from other regions were taken and kidnapped, but it's kind of convoluted because there's a lot of, you know, kind of writings about this later that shows up that kind of takes things in a different direction and try to make it look kind of, you know, satanic and bad. So it's difficult to know what they actually did.
When I was a teenager, I started to have a really negative view about Christianity. And I was just not wanting to participate at all in our traditional family gatherings. I started to have a pretty pissy attitude about it. And my aunt actually sat me down and said, hey, look, you know, all of this stuff that, you know, you think is Christian is actually comes way before Christianity. And this is part of our ancestry. And she, you know, taught me about the original honoring of the changing of the seasons and the real meaning of Yule and the celebration of the return of the sun with the solstice. And she actually said, hey, if you don't like Santa Claus, we can get rid of all these silly Santa Clauses. And we really put a lot of focus on the animals. Like all of the decorations I have on my tree are all animals. And she taught me about how that signified the, you know, giving thanks to the gods. And she also taught me about the colors of Christmas, and I did learn about the red balls and that signified giving thanks for the meat that was providing sustenance throughout the winter. So that kind of turned my view. And I
were you afraid of Santa? Was that one of the reasons why you got rid of him when you were young?
You know, I always was really afraid of Santa.
I think a lot of kids are, aren't
Santa,
they?
Santa, Satan.
Yeah.
Well, I had a terrible experience with Santa Claus one time at the mall, and my mom, like, forced me to get in line and go sit on his lap. And
uh-oh.
I was like, I really don't want to go sit on this guy's lap. I don't know who he is.
That guy's not a showman.
That is not a real beard. And I actually pulled his beard off as I was sitting on his lap, and he kind of got upset with me and was like, hey, hey. And I ended up crying, and I think I wet myself on his, on his knee. And he got even more upset with me, and from then on it was like, okay, no more Santa Claus for you.
I think kids are afraid of it because it signifies something which was part of the earlier tradition. I don't know. Who knows? Maybe they know on some level.
Maybe they know on some level it's contorted. It's like a really alt version of something that was once and sacred, you know?
Yeah, that's
especially
true.
For me, because my first experience with Santa Claus was he was black, a black Santa on a military base. And I have photos of me crying and scared. So my first experience with Santa was quite scary.
It's funny that you bring up the black Santa, because I've been seeing that lately. If you wanted to Seth Rogen shows a black guy, he's wearing a sweater of a black Santa. And I'm like, hey, that's full-on cultural appropriation. This is winter solstice, and Christmas belongs to white people and white people alone. We are the northern people. We are of the ice. This is a tradition that our ancestors have celebrated for thousands of years, and when you live in cold places in the north like Scandinavia, having the sun return and having more daylight is highly venerated and sacred. You know, we're solar people. You know, in Africa, they're lunar people. They hide from the sun, right? They don't give a damn about the solstice. So this is ours alone. So I get ticked off because, you know, everyone's talking about cultural appropriation. Well, damn it, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Christmas, they're all ripping off from Yule while they tell us we don't have a culture.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, well, it's part of the takeover, you know, to take everything that's sacred to us so that we have nothing to return to. And when you don't have anything to return to, then that makes you a weak people, you know. And I think that's just kind of part of this. It's just been a degradation of our people's traditions to one day, you know, get to the point where they're not there at all.
Yes, he's turned into commercial mush, basically. Nothing stands of it anymore. I mean, the idea of gifts is there as a genuine kind of, the giving of gifts, basically, whether that's to others and friends and family, or, you know, if we give to something else or something higher, our ancestors or something. But what I was thinking about when I was asking if people were, or kids were afraid of Santa, I wonder, because I know for a while it was like a dual kind of character. The Krampus, I think, is kind of more Central European, like Germany and maybe Holland. I don't know if you might know, John, exactly what countries Krampus was big in. It was maybe some Slavic countries as well, maybe. I'm not sure.
Yes.
Yeah, it's in more southern Germany.
Right.
In the Alpine area. And it's also, you know, known in other places like Prague or Praha, and just in that kind of area.
Yeah, because we had we have the bock, you know, the goat in Sweden, and I remember he was the one who both, I think, handed out the gifts and also could punish you. I think the idea of just, you know, have you been nice this year comes from an overlap of that, basically, that you had to watch out for this guy because he might turn on you, take care of business.
Now, what do you guys think about the Amanita mushroom Santa idea? That he's the shaman and he consumes the, you know, psychedelic mushrooms along with his reindeer, and they have this whole flying experience. The mushrooms are red and white. He wears red and white. What do you guys think about that?
Dreams of definitely. Sugar plum fairies dancing in your head.
Well, I personally, like, I really enjoyed looking into different kinds of shamanism, and in my journey trying to learn about these things, there was this sort of like block on European shamanism, and where it's not really talked about, and but it's really is all there, and the Christmas story is a shamanic sort of story, and I've heard traditions of all sorts surrounding this, where like even in Christian era Europe, in Germany they would have kids go out and pick mushrooms, these Amanita mushrooms, and they would have them and take them inside and then hang them up over the fire to dry out. And then the parents would have the mushrooms when the kids would go to sleep at night, you know, and for their little enjoyment. And that is where people started talking about reindeer and people flying in the air and such. But yeah, that mushroom is always popping up in these stories of Christmas, even like, you know, like you were describing, really, you know, before Christmas, and it just still kept along for some reason.
But Odin, he also rode, he flew in the sky with the horse, right, Sleipnir, and he has eight legs, right? And then it comes about that there's eight reindeer, and reindeer come from the north. And then Odin leads this big, great hunting party through the sky on his eight-legged horse, you know, Sleipnir. And then he leads, like, huntsmen's and hounds through the sky. And then the children, they would place boots full of hay outside the doors to feed this horse, Sleipnir. And then Odin would give them a gift in return. So that's why we hang the stockings on the mantle. That's why kids like to leave the gift for Santa. It's like leaving it for the gods. So all of these ideas are actually in Norse myth. Even the mistletoe comes from Baldur, who was, you know, he died from a mistletoe that speared him in the side, basically, like, kind of like Jesus, you know, again.
Right.
And then the story goes that he's going to awake again during Ragnarok, during the Norse apocalypse.
Yeah, what was it with the, it's kind of interesting there with the other plant there, too. Well, with the European mistletoe, with all the, with the berries and the fact that it grows high up in the crowns of other trees, which makes it also kind of an evergreen, right? Because it's, doesn't it, when all the other leaves have fallen off the tree that it's in, it still remains green. I don't know if it's, is it for the rest of the year or is it just a period? I didn't look into that yet.
I remember when we were up there in winter, I've seen bunches of them up in the trees, you know, and of course they're parasitic, so they're living off of
Parasitic or something like that, they call it, but yeah.
But in order to pick them in the old days, they had to find out a way to get way up in the trees to get that, you know, so that's probably why we hang it up high. And then also another reason for kissing comes back to the fertility. I was looking into these white mistletoe berries, and apparently they use them to help with infertility. And it's kind of funny because they're white, and if you pop them, it's kind of like the consistency of semen, you know, so here we find the white again, and then people kissing underneath the mistletoe, you know, perhaps maybe even thinking that it's going to birth, you know, a child that might even be Baldur who comes back. So there's some interesting connections there.
Interesting. Yeah, because I remember reading about, there's this one guy in Sweden, Carl von Linné, or Linnaeus, I think his kind of Latin name is, and he's one of these guys that's mentioned the most. Wikipedia did some kind of cross-referencing of all their threads or all their posts, and to find out who's mentioned most. And I think it was on number first was second was Hitler, and then on number on the first place was this guy called von Linné, because he cataloged all these different plants and all these different you know, species and things like that. So he's like mentioned a lot. But he, interesting enough, he talked about this very interesting area in Sweden, which is kind of believed to be one of these sacred groves, basically. It's up on a high mountain in the southwest or mid west of Sweden. And he tells a story when he got up there, and this is like in the 1700s, that there was a tremendous amount of mistletoe up in the some of those trees. Now, it started to kind of decline after that point, but it was almost like someone actually grew that, or like enabled them to grow in this area because they were sacred, right?
So, well, remember, we looked into it, too. There are ritual plants, and they have alkaloids. And as we know, alkaloids make us feel good. So perhaps they were actually harvesting these and using them in some of their rituals, too.
Right. Well, that's interesting.
I mean, alkaloids help with depression. You know, if you've lived through a Nordic winter, you know how depressing it can be, long and dark. You know, you want a little pick-me-up. So that would make sense.
So they did some kind of brew or some concoction or something like that?
Yeah.
I've got to try it. Was it... It was like a little bit, was it not poisonous, but there was something in
semi-toxic,
it. Semi-toxic, yeah. Okay.
Just like alcohol.
Oh, it's very toxic, isn't it? Well, you know, there's so many things that kind of converge and come together, I think, from so many different stories that has to do with survival and mythology and things. And I think one of the things with the fire, which seems to be important, the idea that you light a fire in the midwinter or midwinter, which is an idea of trying to bring the sun back, right? Because they went through something called Fimbulvinter, which was basically eternal winter. It never got warm again. So I think there's some kind of memory of survival here that, you know, we give to the sun. We venerate the sun. We try to do everything we can to kickstart the sun again at the darkest point where it's lowest in the sky, when it's the the longest night or the shortest day, we light these massive fires to like kindle the sun to come back again, which is really where the idea of the log comes from, the Yule log that you throw on a bit, you light the biggest log you can imagine.
For 12 days sometimes is what they did, right? Because Yule went for 12 days, so they would go chop down a tree. Sometimes, some stories say they used the stump and they burned that. They'd carve like wishes, you know, or runes or whatever in the log, and then they'd burn it, and then they'd use those ashes like magic for different things. And I was reading that ashes can be used for a lot of different things. I mean, from dyeing hair to fertilizer to soap. It's amazing what you can do with it.
Yeah, but, or make a lampshade.
Or make a lampshade.
Yeah, it's really good stuff. I think when people kind of connect all the dots, I think just as you said, Melanie, you know, it's like I was also I didn't like the idea of Yule or Christmas. It was a combination of just being, you know, kind of dorky, but also kind of materialistic and, you know, a lot of different things. But I think when one learns what it's really about and when it kind of when you can put everything in perspective, what it really means. At least I got like an ignited interest in it again, and something I wanted to do and encourage and find out more even. Oh, why did they do this? Why did they do that? There's so many things, so many layers to it.
Yeah, it also, for me, it allows me to kind of understand our current predicaments and where we've come to be here at this point. And the whole true meaning of, like, this time was, you know, for people to come together at that darkest point, the coldest point, you know, people need each other. And so in the coldest areas of this planet, people are going to come together to try to help each other to survive. And I think, you know, when I'm looking at this, when I see that fire, I see it's like that's the attempt to stay warm. And in even like the gift giving is kind of like, okay, well, you're, you know, helping each other, your brothers and sisters and your friends and such. And even within all that darkness and cold, you try to make it joyous and happy and to think about what it's going to be like when the summer comes around, you know.
Right.
And so it's just like it's just all connecting from like from people, family, to nature itself, to honoring that nature, you know, whatever it is that you'll deal with it together.
Well, that's a northern trait specifically. I mean, you were forced to do it to survive, which is, well, it's kind of what Kevin MacDonald talks a little bit about, you know, in terms of the conditions that seem to have created a little bit of a different mentality, both when it comes to planning ahead, but also being accommodating to, well, not the stranger, but those you might not know, that ultimately you see them as an extended family because, you know, you might be in a situation where you need each other to survive, basically. So that high level of trust exists within it. So it's something that specifically has been ours, you know, and now it's kind of disappearing. And it's not disappearing, but it's like it's being perverted into something else. And all these other kind of Johnny come latelys are showing up on the scene trying to like grab the season and what that means to us, and kind of use it for themselves, like Kwanzaa, like Hanukkah.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think that when we retrace, you know, we go through the winter solstice, we have the fire, we do some of the rituals, we're getting in touch with our line, our ancestors that have done this for thousands of years. And it gives me chills when I heard that piece you played there, you know. I can kind of connect back into that solar kind of consciousness and that survival mode and that folk mode. And I think that there's a lot of power there. So if we learn to bring back some of these solstice festivities and get in line with it and reinvigorate that within us, I think it is like a metaphysical thing where you can connect with your people and find this other kind of power. At least it's been that way for me just researching this and getting back into it. I get chills reading some of these things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, same here. And that piece is from the 70s. And what's interesting for me is that, you know, prior the 80s, you'd see more examples of people trying to talk about these traditional origins of Christmas and pagan beliefs and such, But somewhere along the line, over the past like 20, 30 years, it's become more and more suppressed, where we, you know, where it's just like everybody in America and Europe who call themselves Christians, they follow this sort of like something that's new, that's not the same as it was even 30 years ago, you know, when that piece was created, to talk about the Christians when they came, or whatever term they use in the piece.
Yeah. Well, it's like the Christmas obviously borrow a lot from this. They, the idea of this, you know, as I said in the piece, is like a word play, sun, right? The sun is awakened, the sun is born again.
This idea, too, that our ancestors were just these horrible people before Christ, right? They just had orgies and drank blood all day and just misbehaved, right?
Of course.
And then I find the people today that are trying to, some people that are talking about some of these pagan festivities, and when you think of what pagans are today, you see these like kind of annoying, witchy, Wiccan kind of, you know, girls, and people are just bastardizing what the true spirit of it is, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's like that what's interesting is that Christmas obviously is a facsimile, but now it's like, interesting enough, not even that is like kind of allowed now. You know, you have to say Happy Holidays. You can't say Christmas. That's offensive. You see Xmas everywhere now too. So they're like, even they take the thing that was borrowed and the facsimile, and then they attack that. Maybe not for not being genuine, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's brought up eventually anyway. That it's like, well, it's just constructed anyway. So who cares, right? So we don't need it. So we can throw it out now. So which means that even those few remnants that is left within Christianity from prior times. Is something that we can't get to.
Well, and also, too, I know for you up in Sweden now, you're not even, you know, here we have to say Happy Holidays. You can't even say Christ anymore. And by the way, it was a lot of Jewish organizations that have fought very hard to remove any Christ references while a menorah is standing in front of our White House.
Yeah, we got to talk about the Hanukkah stuff later. But
even in Sweden now, they're wanting you to say, what do they say? You can't say Happy?
Yeah, they say God helg. And helg basically means like, well, it's weekend or like maybe holiday or, you know, when you have time off, basically.
To not offend the newcomers, right?
Right. And you see it everywhere in stores and everything. So they've adapted that American PC kind of script of saying Happy Holidays and translated that into Swedish, which is, you know, ridiculous. The word jul, as we know, comes from jul or something, I think, in the Old Norse, which was that 12-day celebration kind of thing. So I think it's something that starts on Lucia, which is something which occurs on the 13th of December in Sweden, also very, very unique to Sweden. I believe Norway does that, and I'm a little uncertain if Denmark does that. They might. Sorry that I can't remember that, but anyway, it's quite unique to Sweden. But if you begin on that day and work yourself all the way up to what the like 23rd or something. And the next following days, that's when the sun goes back again up in the sky. This whole astrological thing behind it, right? So it's at the lowest at the sky that it can be. And before it turns back again, 3 days have passed. So it basically means, you know, the sun dies on the 21st. That's the winter solstice. That's the lowest it will be. And then 3 days later, just like the story of Jesus, it's reborn again, meaning it comes back to life. It's turning over again and you know, we enter into a new cycle, or even on the cosmic wheel, which is interesting because you have jul, actually means wheel in Swedish as well.
Well, we should also talk about Frigg there, because there was a huge female aspect to Christmas, obviously. You know, we bring in the new life, right? She births the new son, like the Mary story. And in some Nordic countries, they would say Mother's Night before the solstice, and that makes sense because, like in Norse myth, the goddess Frigg, she's the wife of Odin. She's like the most beloved goddess, and she was goddess of marriage and household and motherhood. Well, she sits in her palace and she spins clouds to float above Midgard, the human world, and she basically spins this wheel of life, bringing in the new sun or the change in season. And it just so happens to be that her son Baldur, who's also one of the favored ones, is the god of light. And then, of course, then you've got Odin, the father of Baldur, Light, and then Frigg, the mother. So you've got the trio right there.
Yeah, it's like it's a kind of like a combo thing between Odin and Baldur. You kind of have that kind of a Christ deity, basically, right?
It's true.
Yeah.
And they seem to find that in a lot of, you know, around the world, a lot of Christ-like figures that seem to have stuck around.
Yeah, what's the other, exactly, there are a couple from
Egypt,
even the
Egypt,
not Hindu, mm-hmm. and yeah, exactly, it's very similar. It's that, you know, root religion, basically, which is quite interesting. I think there's something to that, and then you had a kind of a migration out probably from the ancient world, maybe up north, or maybe from the north and down, maybe that's when the first invasion was. It's damn difficult to say, but I think it's quite evident that it's based on survival, the need to know that there's a guarantee that the sun will return again and that there will be ability to survive in those really, really cold climates. So, yeah, let's talk a bit about Kwanzaa first, and then we can talk about Hanukkah, but I wanted to give you've done some research on this, and it's quite interesting, Lana.
Okay, it's huge. I mean, we just did like a 40-minute video, but, you know, you hear people saying, oh, nowadays we have to say, you know, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa, you know, Merry Christmas, and we're told that Hanukkah is for Jews, and then Kwanzaa is for blacks, but Christmas is for everyone, right? And you can't have, the winter solstice is related to Norse mythology, that's racist, right? According to SPLC, you know, Thor's hammer is a symbol of hate, right? So we're the one group that's basically not allowed to have an ethnic celebration.
Wasn't it the Celtic cross as well they deemed to be a racist symbol?
That's right. And as we know, the sun cross, the sun wheel, and by extension, the swastika are ancient symbols that have been found all over. These are our ancestors' symbols. You know, we should be taking these back. But I was looking into Kwanzaa, and we're told, you know, oh, it's about honoring African heritage. You know, but really, in reality, it was a manufactured scam. It was created in the 60s. I don't know if you guys know this, by a rapist, a torturer, and he was an FBI stooge. His name was Ron Everett. He goes by Milana Karenga now, and he was the founder of United Slaves. They were a rival to the Black Panthers, and he got in some shooting episode with them over some Black Studies program at UCLA, and they, like, shot two people, you know. It's hilarious, but turns out Ron was working for the FBI reporting on some inside, you know, information on the Black Power scene, which, as we know, was instigated by white Marxists in America. It wasn't just a grassroots type of thing. He has this major record, and then he goes to jail for a few years because, like I said, he tortured and raped even his own female Black comrades. He gets sentenced. Right. He goes to jail. He comes out in a few years, and then he heads up, what school was it? The Black Studies Department in Long Beach, California State University, and he's writing books on African ethics and Black studies that are published in our freaking textbooks in America.
Right.
Okay, so this is the guy who supposedly brought forth this holiday, and there's all these anti-white and Marxist overtones to the ritual, which is a total fraud. I mean, they speak in Swahili, which, you know, all these Blacks that are in America now have nothing to do with Swahili culture. It's supposedly this harvest festival in December, and it's like they're harvesting things that Africa doesn't even grow. I mean, there's just like, it's such a scam, you know. And then this guy, it turns out, he's really pushing multiculturalism, so I'm thinking he probably still works for the FBI trying to incite racial hatred, get things going, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, basically it's like a blacks-only anti-white celebration, and his buddy Al Sharpton was saying, we need to de-whiteize Christmas. And I'm thinking, that's impossible, because this is our tradition. This is our holiday, you know?
Yeah. So it's it's cultural appropriation, basically.
And it's no coincidence that they're doing this in December, because it's like a big middle finger to our month, you know, our winter solstice, and they're even kind of ripping off some ideas from that. These are blacks. They don't celebrate winter solstice, you know. We're the northern people. So I feel like they're also trying to jockey for that energy and take it and kind of be a giant middle finger to us in our sacred time.
It's like a political aim. It's just because it doesn't have a tradition, it doesn't have a root in anything, so let's try to, you know, take that, take the season, take the energy of that, and supplant something else on top of it. Kind of what happened with Hanukkah too, really, because they put it in there. They said, you know, that what some of the Jewish kids, they felt jealous, or they felt left out and stuff like that, because it's like Hanukkah is very recent.
Yeah, people don't know that. And when you see all these Jewish-produced movies, you guys probably have too, you think Hanukkah is ancient because they're talking about their ancient Jewish traditions, right? Aren't they always going
the,
on about
with
that?
With the Maccabees and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. And then I learned that when I started researching, it wasn't until like the late 1800s where there was this rabbi who was getting concerned that the Jewish kids are they're getting lured into Christmas. And he saw how, you know, non-Jewish kids were getting excited about their culture and stuff. And so he basically borrowed concepts of Yule and started coming, you know, manufacturing basically Hanukkah. But it wasn't until the 30s and 40s when I think her name was Henrietta Zold, real fine looking lady. She is believes that let's take the Hanukkah celebrations and put them in line, basically reshape them in line with Christmas ones. So Hanukkah has, and I go through this in the video, rips off many aspects from Yule, but if you go back far enough,
it all kind of looked the same. That was interesting. It was basically like they've taken largely every symbol that we have within the Christmas or Yule tradition, and then basically turn it like Israeli blue, you know, and like put Stars of David's on it.
Yeah, that's all they do. I mean,
they had a blue bush, like what, I don't know, from like the burning bush or something. Like instead of the tree, they had the bush, and then they had socks or stockings, right?
Well, in reality, I detail this in the video, people don't know what Hanukkah's about, but, you know, in Hellenistic culture, Syrian Greeks, the Jews were welcomed there. They lived there for a long time. They had, their own communities. They lived in peace. Well, eventually they started pushing more for Yahweh and, you know, I mean, these were pagans. They were already tolerant, but then Jews were coming in there causing trouble and a new king arose. His name was Antiochus, and he was like, okay, I'm going to put an end to this. I'm not tolerant to these kinds of conspiracies and people saying, because basically, you know, pagans, Jews and Arabs look at pagans as like worse than Christians, right? Yahweh,
right.
Like Abrahamic gods,
yeah,
despise pagans.
Wasn't it some of them that actually, it was so open, if you will, that actually some of the Jews actually converted, but they started basically adapting pagan traditions.
Exactly.
And stuff, right?
They were swept away by it, and then some Jews were concerned, like, uh-oh, we're losing our people, almost like Christmas again. We're losing them to Christmas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were pushing and doing some things. You're told that they were just kind of innocent and not doing anything, and Antiochus one day just shows up to one of their sacred temples and just destroys everything, erects this statue of Zeus. He bans the Sabbath and circumcision and allows
for no reason
out of nowhere, you know, in this place where the people have all kinds of gods. He just lashes out for no reason and destroys their temple. Well, this one Jewish family, basically a priest, what was his name? Judas. They renamed
Maccabees,
his name.
Maccabees.
Yeah, they renamed his
name. He was
his
some. Name. Yeah, it was called something else initially.
Yeah, I mean, Maccabean, I think it means hammer in Hebrew. So there we go again, trying to rip off some kind of Norse.
The war.
Exactly. So basically, they staged this big revolt and kill a bunch of Syrian Greeks in this massive bloodbath. And that's what Hanukkah is celebrating. So, and then they consecrate the temple back to Yahweh. Okay, so it's basically like we've overcome pagans and here we are again. We're reestablishing our religion. So Hanukkah's roots are in a bloodbath.
Bloodshed. Great. Wow. Actually, let's play a clip from that because they've started to bring this into the White House every year. As you said, there's a huge menorah outside of the White House that's lit up. And what's interesting is that, you know, while the attack on Christianity is going on and trying to remove the name, trying to remove the reference because that's offensive, these other religions like Kwanzaa and Hanukkah are religions, but celebrations, they're kind of taking center stage in a way. And they're becoming the preferred values now. So it's like it's exactly what happened in the Seleucid Empire to a certain extent. It's like the revolt came because they wanted to get rid of the competition, right? And let's just play that clip. It's from the White House. It's like Obama. It's Israeli Prime Minister talking, and then some rabbi.
Well, to clarify, too, every year the White House has a Hanukkah party. They're not celebrating winter solstice. They don't have Christianity.
Right.
It's just Hanukkah.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Well, welcome to the White House, and happy Hanukkah. Before we begin, let's give a big round of applause to our musical guests, the Maccabees. But this afternoon really is special because we are joined by Israel's president, President Rivlin, and Mrs. Rivlin. Now, earlier today, we had an excellent meeting where we reaffirmed the unbreakable bond between the United States and Israel.
Of course.
Of us come together,
of course,
along with Jews around the world, to celebrate a band of Maccabees who inspire us even today.
Intolerant murderers.
They were outnumbered, they were outarmed, and yet they proved that freedom can prevail over tyranny.
Yeah.
Hope can triumph over despair.
Jews didn't do anything to deserve their temple darkness. Being desecrated.
That sounds like a description of the new Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
Standing here next to the menorah, which we call a Hanukkah in Hebrew, we remember the brave Maccabees. We remember they did not fight against, they fought for liberty. For freedom of religion.
They could have left.
For that.
Well, it's like this, I mean, just pause that. It's like this kind of humanitarian religious kind of lingo. So that's like, you know, emphasizing like they were like going through a French Revolution of their own back then,
yeah,
or something.
And as if they weren't allowed to have their traditions there. Are you kidding? Hellenistic Greece.
Well, they allowed them in.
Welcome
them.
They let them thrive there for a long time. So this is bullshit that, yeah, you know, it was religious intolerance on their part. It's the other way around here.
Let's play this again.
Traditions.
Coming out of the White
for
House this time.
Our traditions. For their ability to celebrate their own identity.
Which they didn't allow in Greece then. They smashed their stuff, right?
Yeah.
It's hilarious, the contradictions and the double standards here. You know, it's like, it's for freedom and liberty and for us to be able to do what we want to do. But we destroyed, you know, some of the Greek temples, and we put a menorah in there and knocked down a statue of
what
Zeus.
What they want is Yahweh, right? Supremacy, basically.
Right,
it doesn't end until they get that.
Right, but these are universal values. Let me play more here.
Hanukkah is the holiday of spiritual activism.
Exactly.
It is a holiday which represents the spirit of human being, created equally in the image of God.
Then why isn't there a sun wheel in front of the White House, too?
Yeah, or a cross even.
With all the schmutz in the world, can you believe that we are here with the President of the United States and the President of Israel celebrating Hanukkah in the White House?
We conquered the pagan temple once again. That's what this is.
And I know we bring many people here with us, each and every one of us. I stand here today for my 90-year-old father, whose parents fled the Ottoman Empire. And as they passed by Lady Liberty, they planted within us the promise that the gates of this nation would stay open for all immigrants and all refugees.
Almost propaganda.
America.
But not Israel.
And I also stand here with my fierce family of clergy and Black Lives Matter activists to the streets of Ferguson to stand firm until all
she's squeezing
members
in
of the
everything,
community
all the
see
highlights.
God in the face of the other. I stand here to light these lights to say no to the darkness of Islamophobia and homophobia and transphobia and racism and anti-Semitism and all the other isms that dare to dim our hope.
Can you see why the Greeks wanted them out?
Like President Rivlin said, I stand here like the Maccabees of old who defied the culture of their time.
Right.
That said their destiny could not be changed. And instead, they jumped in to write a new story that demanded freedom and equal opportunity.
You write stories,
but
all right.
But not for the Greek pagans. Not equal opportunity for the Greek pagans, though. Yeah.
Today, friends, we stand with the President of the United States and the President of Israel, who today stand together in this critical moment in history when we must do everything to ensure security for Israelis, and in spite of all odds, like the Maccabees of old.
Again.
But forget us and our culture. It's all about Jewish culture.
What about America?
Join me in the blessing. Baruch atah Adonai.
All right, that's enough of that. Well, so it's like a new kind of... we haven't detailed that yet, but... Hanukkah in America is basically what, like the 60s or something?
30s and 40s is when it started catching on, yeah. They basically looked back in history, some rabbis, and were like, oh, here's an event, let's glorify that and call it Hanukkah.
Right, I mean, obviously this idea that they had one day of oil and it lasted for eight is like a fairy tale.
It's a story,
yeah. But it's like, but it's still that idea of a light. It's hijacking that idea of a light, right? Of a source of light that lights the world and guides the darkness of the goy who's like misled in their paganism.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. The White House resembles, it's almost like Hellenistic Greek again, the pinnacle of, you know,
and look,
culture.
Look at the design, even of the White House being like a, you know, in Palladian classical architecture.
Yeah,
I mean, it is the temple of our time.
They've overcome again, and the menorah is the one symbol that's allowed there.
Yep.
And it's bullshit about this religious tolerance, because try and go, you know, I mean, Jews are constantly attacking us for being into our culture and getting into Norse myth. And I mean, they're calling, attacking that and calling it racist. They're completely intolerant of other things that aren't Jewish culture. I mean, look around. Jewish culture surrounds us everywhere. I mean, that's basically consumed America.
Yeah, and this new kind of like, yeah, it's a pseudo-religious, it's like based on, you know, a combination of like political correctness and humanitarianism, egalitarianism, all this new mumbo jumbo that's coming to us from the state power, the authorities, the establishment, the New World Order, if you want to use that term on it, these globalists, but it's enforced. See, with this, like the poison is served with sugar, right? So it will bypass any kind of rational opposition to this, basically.
Well, if they were truly fighting for religious freedom, then they'd say, hey, let's get all the symbols together, right? And they'll say, put all the symbols together in front of the White House, right?
Right.
And she would also be judging Israel for their utter intolerance of other religions, other races,
Palestinians.
Other cultures.
Genocide.
Exactly. But they don't do that.
No. I heard nothing in there about that. Well, I think she threw it into, it's again to like make it seem good and all that kind of stuff. But I do find it interesting because they mention in some of their talks here, they constantly bring up the Maccabeans as some kind of, well, they're basically trying to turn that into like the, you know, like the Spartans or something, you know, like they defied all, you know, odds kind of thing. I even saw several articles online searching for it. They actually took Leonidas as a symbol and said, well, think of the Maccabeans kind of like Leonidas of their time, you know, stuff like that. Try to like reinvent it and everything. But what's bizarre about it is that it's like, it's so recent. It's so just brought together in a recent fashion to create it. I think she even said they wrote a new story.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Or they wrote a new, they defied it by writing something new.
That's what they do. They always write stories. Jews, rabbis will tell you, we write stories. But here's the thing that people have to remember. Jewish expulsion, okay? There's at least, you know, over 110 places they were kicked out of. Oh, do you think they were just kicked out for no reason? Do you think all these different cultures just for no reason other than them being Jewish kicked them out? See, they're inciting things. They're creating things everywhere they go, and then they finally get kicked out, and then they still don't look at themselves and how they were behaving. So I kind of, as I was doing this video, I had this theory of they basically came into this culture. They saw an opportunity to basically take over the culture. They've destroyed our true culture, supplanted this Jewish culture. So now they never have the threat of being kicked out. Because if we were really in touch with our true culture, we would see these shenanigans and we would say, out you go, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what the whole multiculturalist kind of credo comes from too, I think. That they're inserting that in there a little bit in all of these kinds of, when they have these celebrations, it's becoming more and more kind of obvious that they're not tolerant of our customs, of our values, of our, you know, of our ethnicity, of our, you know, everything that we cherish. So it will be forced to do a Maccabean revolt against them. Because
exactly.
they're doing what they claim that we did towards them, and then they have no ability to see that. Wait a minute, what are you doing now? You're taking your symbols and putting it in our temple, basically.
Well, it's just interesting because in this Hellenistic time, you know, it was the pinnacle of their culture there, and things were good. You know, they had a culture. People were already, you know, pretty pluralistic, and things were going really well. But then they started instigating things, and it makes me think of multiculturalism. Sweden and all these countries in Europe, who are the biggest advocators of multiculturalism?
Right. Yeah. I know.
You know, why can't they just leave that culture alone? Why do they have to insert themselves all the time everywhere to the point where they just annoy the hell out of everyone?
Well, it's a way of hiding in the pluralism, so to speak, I guess some would say that is a contradiction, because to a certain extent, they are in a position where they also kind of stand out as moral supremacists, if nothing else. But it's a way to hide among the masses, the masses of other cultures and people, basically.
And isn't it telling the Jews are what 2% of the American population? 2%? And yet there's a giant menorah representing America in front of the White House?
Well, I think one of the guys said that was these are American values. They're Jewish values and American values. That they're one and the same. They're interchangeable. In other words, I think people need to just see past who they are, see past their religion, see past all that. It's a way to kind of like position themselves in a power center, in the center seat of power. And also morally, that's saying that we are a moral guiding light of Western civilization, basically. And without that, we would be lost. I've heard that several times, actually. I don't know.
What do you two think?
Yeah, I mean, I see it too. They are, you know, they'll leave their beliefs and spiritual beliefs or whatever they want to, you know, celebrate, but take away the traditions of, you know, like the United States. Like, if they have the Jewish menorah in front of the White House, why aren't they celebrating Christmas? And actually, they just stopped a tradition that they did every year, a Christmas special that would air every year, basically doing the exact same thing except with a Christmas theme. And after 33 years, they've stopped that. The TV networks, which are, you know, Jewish ran, they decided that they weren't going to do this Christmas special anymore. So after 33 years, they've decided, yeah, that's gone away without any announcement or anything. It's just not going to happen. But it's just kind of odd now that I see these Jewish celebrations just being openly accepted for that 2%, you know?
Yeah, and they hate Christ. That's what Christians don't realize. They reject him as the Messiah, and they hate what he represents. And my theory is it's because it's coming from something older that's Norse, and they still feel that remnant in there, and so they still despise it, you know? Because I know there's different theories about Jesus. You've done shows about this. I mean, that's a whole other tangent.
Yeah, you mean that there's some kind of overlap in the mythology, so it needs to be displaced entirely? Even so that, you know, as I said, those small little grains of sand that's still in there, they need to go, basically,
yeah.
Vanish. Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Well, I got to say, you guys, I live in Oregon, and Oregon is pretty traditional still. I live in a very white Christian state that is still honoring many of the Christian traditions, and so I don't see a lot of this stuff that you guys see. I mean, I drive down the main drag in town, and it's Merry Christmas and, you know, Santa Claus, and I don't know. I don't
Oregon's one of those last havens, but I think they're working to
give them time. Give them time.
Right.
Well, I think the thing is there, it's about kind of what popular culture is doing right now. It's about what popular culture is doing and in what way they can kind of bring this in now so that in 10 or 15 years, the kids that have grown up with this are not going to be accustomed to it anymore. They're not going to like it. So I think it's about the kind of, it's kind of like a little bit of an occult magical act of like kind of speaking the reality or writing again. It's back to that idea of telling a story which is different and then kind of imposing it by will and by means of communicating that constantly over and over again, like mind control almost. And then eventually that's enforced.
That's why it's important to raise our children now to tell them the true story so that this tradition isn't lost forever, because that would be a travesty. The other thing is that people need to know that the Jewish influence in Christmas right now, we get into this in the video as well, but like half of the top Christmas songs are written by Jews.
Those 50s... classics
or
whatever.
Yeah. A lot of these Christmas movies are Jews. A lot of those creepy Santas that are working on Christmas are actually Jews because they're the only ones working on Christmas. So it's basically contorting, destroying, changing what Yule is really about, turning it into some jingle bells bullshit, you know, like buying presents and just being stupid, you know?
It was a China-made crap. Sorry, John, go ahead.
Well, it's just the same with what was covered in Hollywoodism. How they came to America, and then they took this form of art to turn what was America into what we think of America now,
yeah.
The Hollywood America. So it's kind of like an extension of all that.
Yeah, and it's super
Hollywood.
Exactly, and it's super easy to like attack that because again, if it's a facsimile, if it's something which is not genuine or rooted in something which is true, then people, I think, ultimately isn't going to be attracted to it. They might be attracted to it first for, well, I don't really know for what reason. It's more glam and it's more pop and it's more short term. I don't know what to call it, like just glitzy. I don't know. It's glamour and all that kind of crap, you know, stars and it works. Unfortunately, in many cases, it works. And then eventually, you can attack that culture that you created as a secondary means. Because no one is going
to
buy it.
And it's based on a lie, though. That's why it's important to tell the true myths and resurrect some of these rituals and reenact this and bring back the spirit of our ancestors. I think it's important now more than ever to combat this onslaught, this force that's working to just destroy everything sacred on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of this is our fault for being suckered, for being stupid. And it's, yeah. You know, our parents and grandparents' fault for not passing on this knowledge and instilling it into us, you know, with our children, you have to raise them to teach them what all these symbols are, what the rituals are, get it ingrained in them so they get excited about it, like how we grew up getting excited about Christmas, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Without the Jesus part of it.
Well, you know, again, it's like, I know there are others who might still, you know, hang on to that, and that's, you know, I'm perfectly fine with that. These are, you know, these are up to how people want to choose. You know, celebrated or whatever, but it's, they should know the origins of it. They should know at the very least what is at the background of that. How were they inspired? I think there are probably some Christian branches that are turning against, you know, the 23rd or, you know, that it was born on the 23rd or whatever, because it's actually not factually true. If, you know, if he even was alive,
yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. Oh, yeah. 25th. Exactly. I'm thinking about the solstice there, but, because, you know, any tradition that we might celebrate when we're young, we don't know if it was made just yesterday, and because you can see that working with Hanukkah and Kwanzaa, they have literally invented those. That's literally proof that you can just create something, and then a generation or two later, they're all about it, and they keep saying, oh, it's thousands of years old, you know, or whatever. I don't think they do that openly with Kwanzaa, actually. Maybe a couple of hundred years or something. I don't know what they say there, but at least Hanukkah, I know that they're trying to make that, what, like 2,000 years old or something, that tradition, maybe even more. So it works. You can invent it, you can invent a new tradition and it works. The upside that we have, the plus side is that we don't have to invent it.
No.
We already have it. We have
Thank
the genuine,
you.
The real stuff. So all we need to do is to bring that back and know what we're doing, encourage those celebrations, and that, I think, will resonate deeper than anything else because they are built on natural principles, on real things that have to do with survival and camaraderie and gifts and giving back to nature that's giving so much to us.
Plus, there's been thousands of years of focus on it. Think of all our people that have focused on the solstice, and I think that, you know, people that are more knowledgeable in the occult and esoteric stuff, they know that they can kind of ride on some of that energy, right? That's why
right.
They're concocting these holidays around that, trying to get some of that ancient energy.
Mm-hmm.
But really, when you think about it, the whole world is culturally appropriating things from European culture, but no one talks about that. But it's time to start talking about it. It's time to start talking about how Yule has been culturally appropriated.
Yeah.
Well, there needs to be people telling the stories, the storytellers, to teach this new children, these children of these days. And, you know, this is actually, seems to me, like opportunity for lots of stories to be created and movies to be made, because these origins aren't, you know, ever really talked about. It's just the same Hollywood versions of things that come out every year, you know, another Christmas movie or something that's not even about Christmas, you know, but this could be like an opportunity for people to look into these symbols and these origins and to create new movies about them, you know, so that Because I see like media as being a very effective way of getting information to people very quick. It's our modern campfire, pretty much, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
That they've they've kind of perverted in itself, you know, to where we're, you know, as children, we're not being told the stories as they should. But we still have that opportunity now, I think. You know, it's not over yet.
Yeah, I was thinking about that earlier today, how my grandparents didn't really share any stories of traditional Christmas. Anything coming from them was their memories of living through the Great Depression and just being poor and not really being able to, you know, buy presents and kind of being depressed during the holidays. So there was no passing down of these great, wonderful traditions.
Yeah, I think that's kind of indicative of what's happened in the past, too, that when people go through hardship and they go through cataclysms in different ways, whether those are emotional or environmental, that's when we seem to lose grip of it. And that's why in some cases we don't have stories that goes back more generations, because they were in a situation where they had to survive, and they didn't have the luxury to, you know, preserve certain things, let's say, from those who came before. Maybe they had to sell a house that they'd owned in a couple of generations or something. That's really a shame. There isn't a way around that. It's just kind of it's consequences of life, ultimately. Despite those things, I've always been kind of sad about the fact that there's so few things that are passed down, when it's, at least in our day and age now, when it's so easy to, you know,
record
things, even. Exactly. Record and, you know, do something now, and someone might see it in a distant relative, and a descendant of you might see that 100 years from now.
Melanie, it's interesting you bring up the depression aspect of it too, because this is the time of year where I guess there's a lot of suicides and a lot of depression, mm-hmm. and people think it's, oh, they just have problems with family and stuff. No, I think it's an unconscious knowledge of being cut off from any kind of folkhood. You know, no people should be alone during this time. If you're a European, this is the time when we all used to get together and have bonfires and feasts and support each yeah. other, and people that were in need we looked out for. There was a folkhood, and I think unconsciously people know that that's missing, makes them depressed. They know they're cut off from something that's deeper and grounded, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and as you get older in life and everybody gets busy and spread out across the country and the world, it becomes harder to get together. And I mean, that's probably my favorite memories growing up, family holiday traditions, is just all of us actually being able to be in one place at the same time and enjoy a nice meal around the table and, you know, sit for hours and just catch up, you know, sometimes literally for years of being apart. You know, that's what the holidays is all about for me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think it's also important not to get, I was, you know, trying to figure out which day kind of is the most important one. If you want to do something, if you want to be part of this in some way, whether that's, you know, with just a few friends, or whether, even if it's, you know, just if you're by yourself or with your family, whatever your situation is like, so the question is, oh, okay, is it the winter solstice that's important on the 21st? Is it the, Christmas Eve, or Julafton, as we say in Sweden, or is it Lucia, which is a week before? But it's like, it's the whole damn period that's important,
yeah.
even up to like the New Year's, which is also kind of a, a celebration of the cosmic wheel turning. It's, you know, us, even with the fireworks and everything, that's obviously a kind of a recreation of the starry heavens to a certain extent. It's to, you know, signify the great event of when things begin over again. So the whole damn thing is important. And the whole, whatever you do in that regard, I think is better than nothing. And it's better to think about it and realize what it means and try to get in touch with those. I think it's going to be rewarding in a way for people who decide to do that, take that step. But I wanted to ask you guys, and Lana too, and if there's anything that you guys have planned, or something you would want to do if you could do it, or, you know, anything like that. Lana, do you have anything
Well, yeah.
Did you like to do?
Well, I give some tips kind of in the video, but there's a lot of old things that people used to do, from the trees to the plants to the mistletoe, of course. But having a big bonfire or burning a sun wheel, we're going to do that this year, right? We're going to get together with some friends and have a bonfire and actually burn a sun wheel and just maybe even tell some stories of our people or share a couple myths or sagas or, you know, because we'll have people from different European cultures, because this applies to all of us. I know we're talking about Norse stuff, and I believe that that's the oldest stuff. That's why we're more drawn to it. But this applies to everyone across Europe. So, of course, we're going to have food. What are we going to do? You know, some people do lots of decorations in their house from things made in nature, centerpieces, the Yule log. You know, they make specific foods.
Yeah, what did they do? They carved, I like that idea of, you know, carving your kind of a prayer to a certain extent, right? You when you burn the log, symbolically it becomes smoke or vapor. In other words, it rises to the heavens. It comes in contact with something higher, right? So the idea of that is you carve in your prayer, maybe your aspirations or whatever it might be, and then you let that come in contact with the higher forces. And what was it? Some even saved, they saved the log to the following year, and that's when they burn it.
A piece of the log, and then they would burn it again next year, But then some people also do make the big spirals outside with either candles or, you know, parts of evergreen branches or something. I know in Sweden they do those cool kind of like ice candles, right? Like an ice lantern.
Yeah, like a snow lantern or ice lantern. Yeah, it looks pretty nice too.
Lots of lights, lots of being outside, even when it's cold, bundling up, you know.
Yeah, it's very nice. It's so cozy. What about you guys? Anything planned?
Well, for me, I'm personally just kind of taking in some of this, you know, this energy of what we're talking about here, and maybe perhaps starting new traditions that I haven't done before. But right now, like I personally am starting up projects that I can get my father, my brother, and I to work together on. And, you know, we'll have, you know, traditional kind of Christmas dinner sort of thing. But I mean, I personally just think doing something that's something new but connects with my ancient past is something that I want to try this year. And there's just so many things that can be done. And to not do something, that's where the depression can come in. And if you do something, then there's actually some interaction going on, whether it's with yourself and the higher powers or whatever. It's just, I think to not do something would be kind of, you know, missing the opportunity here. Because, I mean, I also think that, like, this time of the year is its darkest point. And people are afraid of, you know, focusing in inward on themselves. And that could be something that, that's something that I try to do every year, is to, you know, try to know myself more and more every year, going through this sort of dark soul of the night kind of time of the year. But, yeah. I don't know. I just want to... Yeah, just try something that's that I haven't done before, you know, like hang meat from a tree and
jerky.
Yeah, exactly. And then I think what they did is that they obviously let it, not that you can do that inside perhaps, but they let it rot, right? They let it, or I don't think it even got to that. I think
animals would eat it.
Exactly, it was eaten, and that wasn't a problem. It's all seen as an idea that you give it back to the nature. You give it back for them giving you life, and then it gets absorbed by the environment, by nature, and that in itself is an act, a conscious act of you interacting with it and you seeing that it's real, seeing that it works, seeing that it did disappear. The gods did take it. You know, it's gone. Mm-hmm. And that's what's important with it. So, you know, even if we do that with like candy or something, I mean, people do that to hang stuff in the tree. Leave a little bit. Don't eat part of it, you know, or something. Even if it, you know, symbolic in that way, or give something back. So we have a tradition in Sweden where we give Santa like you know, porridge with a little bit of honey on it, and we set that out on the.
And your mom eats it.
I think probably the animals eat that too. But yeah, the idea was that the little elves or maybe Santa himself, they eat that, right? We have a tradition that the Santa, there was actually many Santas, or we call them tomten, and they're small, and there are many of them, and they are the ones who keep tidy in nature. They keep tidy around your house. They help you out with stuff, even if you don't know it. They're also tricksters. They can mess with certain things and put somewhere else where you didn't, you know, so you can't find something sometimes, stuff like that. So these little guys, you want them on your good side, right? So they have a lot of power in that way to screw things up for you. So you leave them a little bit of, you know, milk, or you leave them a little bit of porridge, or, you know, whatever you have, basically, yeah, to give back to them. So I think that's an important act.
Yeah, I've done that every year with the milk and cookies.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Melanie?
Our Santa used to like whiskey.
Classic.
So, well, I'm fortunate enough to live near my family this year, so we all went out and got Christmas trees together a couple weekends ago, and we have taken turns getting together at each other's homes and having a nice meal and listening to Christmas music and decorating the tree together, and last weekend we had a great party with a bunch of friends who had actually put on like a holiday bazaar, followed by some fire dancing, which was really cool to see like this big community come together and just kind of marvel in fire dancing. I don't know if anybody's seen that live, but it's pretty awesome. And then we had a party for friends with a white elephant gift exchange, which everybody brings one present to the put under the tree, and everyone has a number, and then everyone draws a number, you go through the numbers, and you get to pick a present under the tree. And the rule was it had to be something used or just something silly or something god-awful. So you pick your present, and then the person after you can either steal your present or pick a new one, and you know, it goes around the circle. I ended up with a really awesome old-fashioned piggy bank that nobody wanted to steal for some reason. It was just a good time and lots of laughs and, you know.
Nice. Well, I think...
What about you guys?
Well, yeah, as I said, I think what we'll do is we'll definitely try to have a decent fire.
Be definitely a bonfire involved on Monday for the solstice.
Yeah.
I think you're right about the inner aspect too. I think Yule is both, you know, external and internal, and if something does happen, I'll have to look at the astrological alignments and see what's happening too, but I think that they understood that as well. They knew that there's an inner work that happens when you go through that dark night of the soul, so I plan to do some of that as well.
Yeah, there's a lot to that. One of the years I wanted to visit one of the places where it's more or less, well, I believe, I believe, I think it might have been the place where actually Uppsala was located, the site that's mentioned in the sagas, which was very important for the blue. There's many sites, there are many Uppsalas too, by the way. There's like over 80 in Scandinavia in total, different places, so it's not settled where exactly where people believe it was or whatever, but nonetheless, there's different important sites and all that, and one of these years, I definitely wanted to go to one or two. There's two locations which is very interesting in the area that I'm from, in Götaland, and I wanted to go there and actually do something there. I even believe that there might be a kind of a smaller group of people that meet there every year and also actually have a bonfire there. It might be on the 21st. It might be on the Lucia, which is on the 13th of December. Not quite sure when they actually do it, but that would be really cool. And do like... kind of seeking yourself back to the real place of where you might actually have taken place and do it that year and really get the feeling for it as well. I mean, it's not, it isn't Halloween, but again, just the idea of you having a long night like that kind of, is it kind of implied that it's a dangerous period. It takes you a little bit closer to, you know, to the unborn and the dead and that kind of idea, to the spirit world and all that kind of stuff. So, I don't know. It might be something to that. Might
yeah,
be
it's true. It's more intense when you're up in Scandinavia. Everyone should experience that. Maybe we should plan some, you know, Yule festivity up there next year. When you're up there in that darkest point, it's a special energy up there once you've experienced those Nordic winters. Then you really understand why this turning point with the sun is so important.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, it's also just like I was saying earlier, how people would come together during this time because it's, you know, cold, people, you know, need each other to survive. So you come together as your clan, helping each other, you know, maybe someone has good meat that's down the street or someone has something else down the other street. And you come together during this time to, you know, ensure that everyone can enjoy their time together, and which is, you know, helps with the loneliness because everyone, you know, gets to that point. I can only imagine, you know, thousands of years ago living in Scandinavia, you know, in the middle of nowhere, you might be the only person there and the next neighbor is, you know, maybe 20 miles away or something. So I can imagine that they would have these traditions to make an excuse to see each other and to come together. But getting through those dark times, you know, there's something important with that. It's just the same with during summertime when it's, you know, it's at its peak, you know, all the white people are at the beach. You know, there's something to that too, you know.
Yeah, midsummers, for sure. Yeah, these are all very important. I think every 9 years there was a large collection of people from many other parts, and I think it seems like they lived, in many regards, they lived much closer to each other in the past too. Although they might have been separate, they still had, you know, local communities which were like small, not towns, small villages really. So that kind of separation, I mean, of course it existed, it was people that were, you know, hermits and, you know, keeping themselves and all that kind of stuff, but it seems to have been a different type of communal society that was actually broken up when the different kind of farm technology came in, and the church also started to, you know, take wheat and taxes and stuff like this, and people started to try to get more land to be able to get more money from and paying taxes and this kind of stuff. Things change radically in a few years. At least in Sweden, I know this is probably true for other parts of the world, but at other times. So that's something we need to get back to. I think just a small local area where you know people, you know that you can you know, trust them and you can depend on them if something happens. And get that good sense of dependency and good sense of community back. I think that's something to aspire to. All right. Well, should we wrap up maybe for this time? Thanks to everyone for joining us, guys and gals. Thank you for your work this past year. And we'll have to do this again. It was fun.
Definitely.
Yes, it was.
Thanks, you guys.
So we'll say God jul och gott nytt år, or happy Yule and what do you call it? Hey, Happy New Year. That's what you say. Right?
Happy Yule.
Happy Yule.
Happy Yule.
All right. And thanks to all our audience as well for listening and for being part of what we do. We're going to have a great new year with many new things and many new updates coming as well. So thank you so much for listening, and you guys are awesome. We'll talk soon.
Du grüßt nicht nur zur Sommerzeit, nein, auch im Winter, wenn es schneit. O Tannenbaum, o Tannenbaum, wie treu sind deine